Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant personal finance editor Helen Crane. And coming up, are you a mover, a flipper, or a forever homeowner? Among its many surprises, the pandemic delivered us a property boom. But in this hot market, what type of property animal are you? Plus, how to learn from investing mistakes, the ethical bank that wants you, and E10 petrol. What on earth is that all about? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, contrary to expectation, the property market over the last year hit fever pitch. More of us were on the move and house prices soared. In that, we've also seen different types of property animals emerge. The movers, the flippers, and the forever homeowners. But what on earth am I talking about? And which are you? First, before we get to that, the market is driven by the desire for a new way of life, not savings. That's a quote from an expert in one of your articles. House prices are up 11% in a year. Even the stamp duty holiday taper doesn't appear to be slowing things down. What on earth is going on first with the housing market? Where's it headed? Helen, give us an overall picture. Set the scene for what's about to come next.
Sure. So the latest nationwide house price index, which was out this week, showed that prices rose by almost £25,000 in the year to August. So that means that the typical home is now worth almost £250,000. That was a bit surprising. So the stamp duty holiday, which has driven a lot of the activity and the price rises in the housing market in the last year, was tapered down at the end of June. The sort of theory was that that would bring down house prices, or at least sort of stop the insane sort of growth that we've seen. But clearly this nationwide data shows that that wasn't quite the case. And the theory of the expert that you quoted, George France, who is a estate agent at Radstock Property, he says that this growth in August shows that actually, the stamp duty holiday wasn't the main driver of this house price growth. Instead, it was the pandemic and the fact that people want to move because perhaps they want more space, they're working from home, they want a garden, you know, they've been locked down and that has changed essentially the way they want to live their life.
Simon, what do you make of it all? I have to say that sort of theory isn't a huge surprise. As nice as the stamp duty holiday would have been, actually, and by and large, it was a bit of a false economy. It was a bit more psychological. It was the final push. If you want to move, this is going to perhaps encourage you a little bit more.
Yes, I think so. And I would say that on a purely anecdotal basis, as someone who happens to live in a part of the country where family homes cost more than £500,000. So previously, in North London, not fancy posh North London, just normal, slightly scrubby around the edges North London, and now in Hertfordshire, and with lots of friends and family who live in that sort of belt around London. And there are plenty of other places actually, you know, around the country where this is true as well, but where family homes cost more than £500,000. So you are forking out tens of thousands of pounds in stamp duty in many cases for people to move. The attraction of saving £15,000, whether that ended up being a false economy or not, but the attraction of saving £15,000 on their tax bill encouraged a fair few number of people I know to move home. And I also know people who work in the property industry around here, I know estate agents and things like that. And a considerable...
But they would want to go anyway.
They wanted to go anyway, but it gave a considerable impetus to their move. It was not the sole driving factor behind their move, but it gave a considerable impetus to their move. Even beyond the point where people started saying, well, actually, now prices are going up to the extent where you're not necessarily saving the money, kind of thing. Now, I think if you'd agreed to deal before the cut was made, and then the cut came in before you purchased, great, you definitely saved your £15,000. If you were quick off the mark and you were looking at properties that had gone on the market before the cut was announced or just after the cut was announced, then you probably did make the saving because they didn't reflect it in there. Maybe after a certain point for very much in demand properties that were seeing their prices rise quite considerably, you did actually, you know, create a false economy. I think the one thing I would say is that it's all very nice to have a desire for a new way of life. But unless you have the savings to back up being able to afford moving to wherever you want your new way of life to be, then you're going to have a problem. But maybe it's that not the market is driven for by the desire for a new way of life, not savings. It's the market is driven by the desire for a new way of life and borrowing. That's the key, isn't it? Is can you borrow the money? Because ultimately, that's what happens when most people make that kind of aspirational move up the ladder to the place where they can get an extra bedroom or a bigger garden, or they want to get out of the town to the countryside, buy that forever home or whatever. It's how far can you stretch on the mortgage? Because quite frankly, we're talking sums often, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of pounds to make that move. And most people find it quite hard to accumulate a couple of £100,000 worth of savings that can entirely fund their house move. So ultimately it comes down to the, what can you get on a mortgage?
Absolutely. Helen, where is this headed? Oh, that question that no one can really answer. But I ask this purely selfishly, Helen, because I currently don't live in an area, i.e. the north, where the average house price is £500,000. However, I am planning on returning home, and home is in the sticks outside of London. And that seems to be where a lot of people have wanted to go, that race for space. There is really not a lot around, and I'm not even looking to buy. This is rental. And we did read last week about the number of people who have chosen to rent while they wait to find a house to then move to. So it's difficult. I'm looking at moving down south and I can't find anywhere really to go. So what I want to know selfishly, Helen, is when am I going to be able to move?
Yeah, I think at the minute, it seems like things are going along in the way that they have for the past year or so, at least in terms of prices. I think what might start to change that is that there looks like there's starting to be some evidence that although prices aren't necessarily going down, fewer people are moving. So the latest HMRC figures showed a 63% drop in the number of transactions in July, which is huge. That hasn't quite translated into prices yet, but I do think that, you know, competition is a big part of what drives up house prices, right? So if there are fewer people bidding on a house, you don't get those bidding wars, you don't go to sealed bids. And I think eventually, if that trend continues, that has to kind of calm down the prices. It seems like transactions are falling off. So wait and see. You might get lucky in a few months.
Okay, I'll wait and see. Simon, in amongst all of this, though, we don't just have the people who are moving. We have the people who are flipping. And we have the people who actually don't want to go anywhere. And this is what we've been talking about and what I've been gassing on about. The movers, the flippers, and the forever homeowners. What am I on about? What are you on about?
Okay, right. Let's go through these. You know, the movers, I would kind of define these as the people who've always got an aspirational eye on moving. Not necessarily aspirational as in they want to show off, but aspirational as in, oh God, it'd be nice to have a place with a big garden, wouldn't it? Or wouldn't it be nice to be closer to the countryside? Or it'd be good to have an extra bedroom. Oh, I do like our house and it is nice, but I do wish I had one of those big kitchen diners with maybe a seating area and a log burner. It's the kind of person who moves home, and even though they've moved home recently, they continue to look at Rightmove. They're still looking at the results. They're just seeing like, well, what's there? What's interesting? They're the kind of person who browses Rightmove for entertainment. Maybe they look at different areas and things like that. A bit sort of maybe property geeky, but they actually put it into action. They actually want to move. Now, lots of people think that they're going to move more often in their life than they do. People think, oh, I'll probably move like within 5 years. Most people stay longer than 5 years. And actually, people are making less moves in their lifetimes now than they were before. But we'll all know people who seem to have moved an inordinate amount of times. Now, they're the right top end of the movers, I reckon. But I think the movers are the ones who are the people you know who actually do seem to move more often than others, or have always got an eye on doing it, and they're always talking about doing it, things like that. Then you've got the flippers. Well, who are the flippers? Okay, so we've got a story about this week that we're going to go into in more detail. But these are the people who buy properties. Maybe they do them up. Maybe they don't do them up. Live in them for a short while and then sell them, move on. And they're not necessarily motivated by the same grass is always greener element that the movers are that I'm talking about. They're motivated by making money. And actually, in a rising market, okay, and you need to be very cautious about this, but in a rising market, or if you have the skills and the inclination to do a property up without spending so much money that, you know, 1 + 1 = 3 in terms of the cost that you've spent rather than the 2 that it's worth, then you can make money this way and you can climb the ladder faster. You can sort of beat the property market in the sense here, because you buy a property, maybe you buy the ugly duckling and then you turn the ugly duckling into the beautiful swan and then you sell it on and maybe you've made a bit of extra money, and that bit of extra money helps you to get another step up the ladder and so on and so on. Or in a very fast market, you can literally sometimes just buy a house and sell it because stuff's going up. The problem is that the next one you buy is probably going to be affected by the same thing. So ideally, in this kind of flipping scenario, you want to be doing a property up some way. And the best way to be able to do this is to be able to do the stuff yourself, so you're not paying workmen or workwomen to do the work for you. I mean, if you're a carpenter or you're a builder or you're an electrician or a plumber or you're particularly handy, then you're ideally set to do this kind of stuff. So those are the flippers, you know, and they're happy to just keep moving because they're making money. And you wonder at what point they're ever going to stop. Will they ever stop? I don't know. Then you've got the forever homeowners. Now, these are kind of the antithesis of the other two. They're not that fussed about making money. They're not that fussed about moving. They might be fussed about moving to their forever home, but once they've found the place they've moved to, they do not want to be going anywhere. These are the kind of people who are out there looking to buy homes that they are not planning on moving from for the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And there's a surprising number of those, actually. There's a surprising number of accidental forever homeowners. People who always think, well, we'll probably move maybe one or two more times and then never move again. And, you know, there's a big chunk of people at the moment, older generation, living in homes that they've lived in for 40 years, for example. And there's pressure on them in some places saying, well, you should downsize. The kids have fled the nest. You should downsize. The kids have fled the nest. Problem is, they quite like their homes. They quite like where they live. And when their kids come home or their kids come back with the grandchildren, they suddenly discover that they don't have enough bedrooms. That's your three categories we're talking about today.
Yes, I think there's also an element of certainly talking about my mum, who is in one of those homes and has been there for a fair amount of time. There's also the effort as well of doing that, of moving, and then seeing some of the house prices now and thinking, oh, goodness me, that's not what I paid when I first bought this place, that's for sure. In terms of the flippers, though, Helen, I mean, I agree with Simon there. If you're a bit handy, it sort of makes sense. And we are in a hot market and I can see the kind of appeal. But then we're also in a global pandemic where people couldn't really move. I mean, you had all sorts of problems going on, you know, shortages as well of materials and labour. But you've spoken to them. What did they tell you, these brave souls who like to flip during a global pandemic?
Yeah, you're right. I think it's something that very much favours the brave. These are often people that were brave enough to buy a property in the very early days of the pandemic when, you know, they might have had to view it remotely. It would have been difficult to find the right sort of lawyers and surveyors and agents and get people to actually help you buy a property. You know, it would have been difficult to actually buy the property, but people who have done that are now hugely reaping the rewards. So we spoke to someone who has made £45,000 by doing absolutely nothing, just bought a home at the start of the pandemic, sold it recently, literally just sat on it and has made £45,000. Other people have kind of become sort of accidental flippers. So we spoke to a lady who sold her home in London to move out of the city, wanted more space, bought a home in Saffron Walden for just over £1 million. She sort of spent time renovating it and, you know, for her own use, but then kind of decided for sort of family, personal reasons that actually the move kind of wasn't really for her. She sort of didn't like the area, wanted to move somewhere else. So she's now going to put it on the market, and it's been estimated that she's going to make £200,000 from that. So it's not bad at all in terms of making a profit. But like Simon said, you know, if you're going on to buy another home, you're going to have to factor those price rises into your onward purchase. So you've got to make sure that you make enough to step up rather than just buying another similar home.
And I think this is where the point of looking for things that other people don't want to buy comes in. Something that's a bit down at heel, something that people are dismissing for some reason, but actually you can change that reason. One of the interesting pieces of advice I was given on property, I think it was actually by Henry Pryor, the buying agent, was when people look at homes, they focus often on the things that you can change and forget about the things that you can't change. So they'll get themselves into a bit of a tiz about, you know, one of the bathrooms or where the bathroom is or where the stairs are or things like that, you know, which are expensive things to change, right? But if a house is weirdly configured with lots of small rooms, little bitty rooms, people get very put off by it and they go, oh, I like the house, but I can't do anything about that. But it might be in a good location. It might have a good garden. You can't change the location of a house. I mean, in some countries, they do actually pick up houses and move them, but we don't really do that much in this country. You occasionally hear about it. You can't, generally speaking, make the garden of a house bigger, but you can change the internal configuration of a house quite easily. And if you look for places that people might be, they don't want them for some reason, but you could make them into something that someone would want, then there's an opportunity there. And I think that's where you need to watch out, because if you're just buying like what would be called a turnkey property, it's absolutely perfect. You walk straight into it, nothing needs to be done. And then you sell that for a profit because the market's gone up. Well, that's great. But if you buy another turnkey property, you're just buying something else that's just gone up because the market's gone up, and so on and so on. So timing the market is extremely difficult in any form of investment. It goes for the property market and it goes to the stock market as well. Bear in mind that basically at the start of the pandemic, everyone thought house prices were going to crash. Yet the ability to actually improve something and do some work on it and make it more attractive to people, you know, remove some of that time in the market. That's kind of like the value investing thing in the stock market, where you're building in a margin of safety because you're going, this thing is too cheap. People are overlooking this and it's too cheap, kind of thing.
Well, you teed me up nicely for the next subject there, Simon. We're talking about investing, and every investor has had bad experiences from time to time. The stock that bombed out of the blue, the growth story that went wrong, the enticing valuation that was too good to be true. We've all been there, even the pros, although they're less likely to advertise the fact. However, Rob Morgan, chief analyst at stockbroker Charles Stanley Direct, says learning from mistakes and having humility tends to stand you in good stead as an investor, I would suggest in life as well, generally. He's given some tips, but before we get to that, picking a winning stock, Simon, it's tough. But how do you identify the mistakes that you've made from the genuine, just unknown misfortunes that can happen?
Ah, well, what you want to do is you want to try to make sure that you have set up the best possible decision-making process that you can. Everybody makes bad decisions. Stuff always goes wrong. Things don't always go the way that you want them to go. What you need to try to be doing is to be making rational, informed, well-researched decisions that you have reflected on, ideally before you act, rather than sort of gut instinct, reaction, FOMO, that's going, it's going up, I need to buy it, kind of thing. And now sometimes you can do that and you can make lots of money. So there'll be lots of people who made loads of money like buying crypto because it was going up. But if you just do that all the time, then you're more likely to come a cropper. And the famous psychologist Danny Kahneman talked about system one and system two thinking. System one thinking is that kind of gut reaction, instinctive, you know, very much led by our biases that we have, and we are by nature sort of programmed to make bad decisions and run with the herd. If you go back to, it goes back like to the old safety mentality of when we were cavemen and women, and you know, a gut reaction was the kind of thing that saved your life, kind of thing, and running with the herd, you know, that's getting away, you're away from the predator. It doesn't necessarily help with investing. What you want is system two thinking, which Danny Kahneman talked about, which is more like reflective. You think about it, you do your research, you try to make a good decision, you reflect on the reasons why you might make a bad decision, you reflect on the biases that might mean that you make bad decisions. And if you can try to make as many of those decisions that you make with the kind of more reflective, more intelligent, smarter system two level thinking than the kind of panicked thinking, then you're setting yourself up as well as possible to try to get things right. But even then, you won't get things right all the time.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. It sounds like the Chimp Paradox book as well. But Daniel Kahneman's latest book is actually Noise, and it's about how to block out noise and bias. So clearly that's something that you need to do as well. Very difficult to do. Tips that Rob gave. Did Rob admit to making mistakes himself? Because it's very unusual to hear the pros say, actually, do you know what? Made a mistake here. I assume he's speaking from experience.
He said every investor in shares has a bad experience from time to time. He's admitting every investor makes mistakes, kind of thing. So the first one, was it a true mistake? I mean, you have to distinguish between a mistake and genuine misfortune. Stuff happens, as they say, possibly with a worse word in front of the word happens.
Indeed.
And a company, you might just get completely sideswiped. I mean, for example, global pandemic. Who'd have thought that was going to happen, you know? And so on. But, you know, if it's just a genuine mistake or something bad happens that you have no control over, then you don't beat yourself up about it. But if it was a proper mistake, if it wasn't just, you know, misfortune, sorry, you know, it was a mistake, then you need to reflect on, well, why did I make that mistake? Why did you buy the stock? Rob says, the biggest piece of advice I can offer in terms of learning from genuine mistakes is make sure you know what you own and why you own it in the first place. I mean, one idea is basically when you buy something, make sure you write down why you're buying it. And then you can look back at that over time. And you can look back at it and go, well, does that reason still hold? Should I still have this thing? Do I still believe in it? Do I still think this is correct? Not do I still believe in it, as in do I still believe in this because I once said it was the case and therefore I must continue to believe in this until the end of time. But do I still believe that my reasons were good?
Yeah.
Have you faced up to your mistake? Football managers frequently say they learn more about their team from defeats than from victories. The same is true for investing. You know, learn from them, face up to them. Do you know your strengths when picking investments? I mean, everybody's a better investor than the person next to them, just like everyone's a better driver, everyone's slightly more good looking, everyone's got more skill at spotting what's good, all that kind of stuff. But you're not, basically. But you might have some strengths. Some people might be better at some stuff than others. And if you can identify those strengths and then target what you're doing towards them, then that'll be good. And then are you humble about your blunders? It's not just about being smart. Sometimes a high IQ can actually be a hindrance if it brings overconfidence. Thinking you know everything can be as dangerous as knowing nothing at all. Hubris, that kind of thing. Learn from your mistakes, have some humility, and don't be embarrassed by them. You know, be willing to talk about them. For example, and we've talked about this before on the podcast.
Own it. I was just thinking about the football managers admitting to learning more from defeats. Yeah, that might be true. But I remember asking Roy Keane if he felt the same after a 6-1 defeat to Everton. He was not humble in defeat on that one and didn't appreciate the question either.
You've had the pleasure of interviewing many football managers in your time, haven't you, Georgie? Yeah. You've had the pleasure of the Joe Kinnear press conference, haven't you?
Yeah.
I've done the Joe Kinnear press conference when I worked in Luton. It was always entertaining.
The very famous one where he swore, sorry, we digress, but 54 times a Mirror journalist. I won't name him just to save embarrassment. I was actually standing outside the door. It was loud, I have to say. I wasn't allowed in because it was the written press and I was radio. Anyway, we digress. The point, actually, that there's something in that if you are going to reflect on your mistakes, you know, you might need to take some time away from the actual event, you know, give it time, process before people start going, did you make a mistake? Hey, so, what you so learned?
Are you suggesting that going into a long 54 swear word filled rant about something is not possibly properly reflecting on it?
I don't know. He'd had a couple of days to think about that. But sometimes it is just really useful to get it out. I wouldn't say in public or press. Anyway, we digress. My question, Simon, though, I'm going to ask you is, I know we did this a few months ago where you spoke about your own mistakes, but just give us the one of them. If anyone missed that episode, the one thing that you've done that you think, oh my word, but it's fine because I've learned from that. Now we've got reflection. You don't have to swear. So, you know, the floor is yours.
Okay. So I think the best one, the biggest one at the time was, and the one I possibly learned the most from, was I invested some money into a smaller company's gold fund. The gold price had gone up loads and everybody was kicking themselves that they hadn't bought gold. But I spoke to someone and they were saying, well, actually, no, there's an opportunity here. You see, the gold price has gone up by loads, but the price of gold miners hasn't gone up by that much. And there's a disjunct here. And the price of gold at this level means that these gold miners are going to be absolutely coining in. They're going to make profits. And so their share prices are going to go up. And it's basically as close as you can get to a surefire thing. And especially these smaller gold miners, they're the ones that are being really overlooked. I was like, that sounds like a great investment. You know, I wasn't writing about this at the time. I wasn't, you know, doing writing about it and then doing it. I was like, oh, that sounds good. I might do something like that for my portfolio. So I put some money into this smaller company's gold fund. And to be fair, the price between the share price of the smaller company's gold miners and the gold price did actually narrow. It narrowed because the price of gold started dropping. But it only narrowed temporarily because the price of the smaller company's gold miners then started dropping in lockstep with it as well. So the gap then got bigger again. Eventually, after making my investment with more money than I should have done at the time, a more sizable chunk of my portfolio than I should have done, maybe it was like 20% of it, because I was like, oh, I can make loads of money here. I'll put a bit more in than I thought, than I think I should do. Eventually I ended up something like 45% down or something like that. This fund was just there stinking up my investment account every time I opened it. Every time I opened it, it was a nice little reminder of what a dumbo I was. And then eventually I was just like, I've sat on this for ages waiting for it to go back up. Another classic investing mistake. And I thought, maybe I should just sell it. Maybe I should just get rid of it. And then when I open this up, I won't be looking at that anymore. And I can move on. And there's an opportunity cost here because the money that I've got sitting in this stinky little small company's gold miners fund could be out somewhere else, put better to work. This just was a bad idea. This was a mistake. This was, you know, I should move on. I should learn from it. So I sold it and I put the money elsewhere. And then after that, I didn't really think about it that much more, apart from times when I was making investments and things I thought were a surefire thing, was tempted to put more money in and thought, oh, do you remember that time you did that really stupid thing? Maybe try not to do that again. So yeah, there's a lesson I learned.
Exactly. I was just thinking how one of the reasons, I guess, that people keep it is because they're just thinking, oh yeah, but we've had so many stories about it just bouncing back up again. And maybe I was right in the beginning. And if I just hold on to it for a little bit longer and da, 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 da. And actually, I loved the fact that you said, I just don't want to look at this anymore. It's like that really expensive, I don't know, vase that you bought. And it's so expensive, but it's hideous. And you think, just get rid of it. Just get rid of it. Helen, have you got any cautionary tales for us?
I do not. But I just love the advice. It reminds me of, I think very much comes from the sort of self-help playbook, doesn't it? You know, write down your feelings, assess, you know, your personal kind of flaws and reflect on what you've done and how you can be better for the future. You're right. It's just good life advice.
There you go, Simon. Like life coaching for investors. That's your next book. I can see it now. Anyway, that's the end of part one. We'll be back shortly after this.
This podcast is sponsored by eToro. And as at This Is Money, we always like to help you learn more. We've got Sam North of eToro to answer a quick question for us. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Simon. Pleasure to be here today.
Okay, Sam, today's question surrounds managing risk. Now, this is a concept that's often discussed in the investment world, but what does risk management in investing or trading terms mean?
Managing risk, effectively. We can never be 100% sure on the direction of investment. So it's important to identify, analyze, and accept that there is going to be some uncertainty. So for me, risk management is one of the most important aspects of being a smart investor and critical for long-term success. I mean, for example, never risk more than you are afraid to lose. Always do your research into what you are investing in. And you know, I say to people, don't risk more than 2% of your account on a singular trade, for example. Decide where the trade no longer makes sense before you've even got into it as well. Be patient. Don't go chasing. You know, want to let the market come to you is all advice that I give to newer traders and investors. And we'll cover that in the webinar that we run. But yeah, risk management, self-awareness and discipline, the top three most important aspects of being a smart investor.
Thanks, Sam. That's a great tip. And if you want to find out more about investing in shares, go to thisismoney.co.uk/share investing.
Welcome back. Now, would you move your current account to an ethical bank? Offers no switching bonus, has no branches, and you may never have even heard of it. And if you have, you've probably pronounced it the wrong way at some stage. But what Triodos offers is more worthy than that. And thousands are getting on board and moving their money across. Now, the boss is aiming to make it a household name. You've been speaking to him. But first, Helen, one of the questions I get asked a lot when talking about sort of switching banks and ethical banking and all that sort of thing is, how can a current account be ethical or not? Surely I just put my money in a bank. It sits there ready for me to take it out when I need it.
Sure. So basically, it's to do with what the bank does with your money. So when you put your money into a current account or a savings account, regular banks, they use that money, first of all, to lend to other customers. So if you sort of mortgages and loans, but they also invest the money in, you know, all kinds of things. And where the ethical element of this comes in is that, you know, you might find banks invest in things that are, people would see as perhaps unethical, things like oil, weapons, tobacco. So the idea of an ethical bank account is that your money is not going to be invested in any of those things. And also that instead of that, they will use the money to do what they perceive as sort of social good. So they might invest in, you know, sort of projects to, you know, save the planet, you know, house the homeless, all kinds of worthy causes.
So who are Triodos then? And what has their CEO been telling you?
Sure. So Triodos, they've come up now because every quarter the current account switching data is published. And Triodos have cropped up this quarter in there between all the typical names, you know, the big banks and the popular challengers. They are sitting in there. They've done quite well. So they've tempted in quite a lot of current account switchers, and not a lot of people are switching away from Triodos. They're clearly doing something well. They are an ethical bank, and they say that they're on a mission to ensure their customers' money is used as a force for good through savings accounts, current accounts, and investments. So it's a Dutch-founded bank. It's led by Bevis Watts, who is a prominent sort of environmentalist, and they promise to only lend on projects that make a positive impact for people and the planet. And they're on a bit of a growth mission, and he has told us that they want to turn Triodos into a household name.
In terms of switching, Helen, we got some switching figures recently, and I think Triodos did very well, but then it's still quite small, so they're coming from quite a low base. The other one that did well, I think, was Virgin Money, because they were at the time offering booze. How popular then, how quickly have they grown, Triodos? As I said, they're still coming from quite a small base, but it seems to me now is a time, particularly, it might just be the mood, the Greta Thunberg effect, you know, all those sort of things coming together, and they're the right group at the right time. It does seem to me people are much more interested now in things like ethical banking.
Sure. So they have gained 1,133 customers in the last few months. That's a net gain. So, you know, it's not huge numbers, but they've only lost 77 customers. So they're growing. They're on a growth sort of trajectory. And, you know, they're never going to be up there with your sort of HSBCs and your Nationwides. But they're sort of growing respectively for a sort of small challenger name. And yeah, you're right. I think people are more interested in ethical investing, and you know, you were seeing it in all sorts of areas of life. So people taking out sort of green mortgages and things like that. It's something people are thinking about more. It's very topical in a lot of areas of personal finance.
Indeed it is. Simon, I actually had an old school friend. I hadn't spoken to her in years. Got in contact with me on Facebook and say, Georgie, you're into all this financy stuff. I want an ethical bank account. Where do I go? And I thought, well, I'll do what most normal people do. I'll ask someone else. And I went to James Blower, the savings guru, and I did a thing with him, and I asked him, you know, what are the bank accounts she should be looking at? And Triodos came out number one, obviously. And the other one that came out was Starling, who I recently moved to. However, there was obviously a bit of brouhaha with Starling about, I think it was March time, was it May time? They took a bit of investment money from the Qatari investment group. And there was a bit of an issue with that. But it highlighted to me that it is incredibly difficult in whatever we do, be it ethical investing, be it ethical consumerism, anything, to know exactly along the chain of events to what we eventually buy or receive in services, where it's been and how really truly ethical it is. So the debate then is, do we just give up altogether, or do we try and make it much clearer? And I don't know how you do this in terms of regulation, in terms of, you know, bodies that look at these organizations, so that we don't have issues of certainly greenwashing, but so that we know much more about where the money's going, et cetera, et cetera. But it's tough. It's really hard.
I think it is hard. And I think sometimes with sustainable investing or trying to put your money into things that say they will do good, the difficulty can be not that there's greenwashing going on or sustainability washing or whatever you want to call it, but that actually there's just different verdicts on what that might count as being from different people. So you might think that if you're investing your money into a sustainable fund, that your money is going to be going into things that are working towards improving our impact on the environment. Perhaps it's going into companies that are helping to improve the environmental effects of agriculture, of clothing, alternatives to cotton, which is very bad for the environment, obviously feeds through into the whole like fast fashion element, recycling clothing, again fast fashion, or perhaps into renewable energy, the shift towards, you know, solar and wind, battery technology, that kind of stuff. And all of those things I think are easy for people to get their heads around. And then they look at the top 10 holdings of the fund, and you've got stuff like PayPal in there, or maybe Amazon or something like that. And you're like, well, how's that sustainable? Yeah. And it's because those companies have apparently made a commitment to being sustainable. And that's what the verdict has been from the fund manager's perspective in terms of the companies they're investing in. So I think you need to be quite careful that you look beyond the cover of the book, beyond the name on the top, beyond the title. Like, what is this actually doing? And what is actually in it? And if I want to put my money to work for a certain reason, is my money actually going to work in that way? Or am I just investing it into a basket of companies that have passed through a screener and that has said that they are sustainable? And I think with the trend towards ESG investing, this has become even more important. And I would say it then becomes a similar thing when you're looking at a bank account or a bank, or even if you're borrowing for someone or things like that, or even where you're spending your money, is to be, if you are genuinely wanting to try to make some of that money go towards certain things and direct a certain thing, then do check what that definition of sustainability or whatever it is that's being placed on it is. And that's not to say that there's a deliberate greenwashing or sustainability washing, or as I said before, although whatever that you does want to happen. Call it. Although that does happen. And you've got to remember that this is very much true with the fad for ESG investing at the moment. Is there's an awful lot of companies going, well, if we stick ESG on it, or if we stick sustainable on it, people will buy it. There's always an element with this kind of stuff of bandwagon jumping. But I think if you can target the genuine opportunities that are in place over the next 10 to 20 years from the tailwind provided by a huge wave of government spending around the world pushing towards greener technology and improving the environment, then you should hopefully do well. But you cannot guarantee that all of those things will go up just because there's some money being chucked at it. Refer back to conversation in podcast previously about investing mistakes.
Indeed, do. Helen, just a final one. If an old school friend gets in contact with me in another 20 years' time, do you think it's going to be inevitable that actually it'll be quicker for me to say the bank accounts that aren't ethical?
Maybe. I think there's definitely a lot of pressure, I think, for companies to at least make some kind of inroads into being more green and more ethical. At the minute, like Simon said, you know, that is often just a bit of a sort of cursory nod to sustainability. But I think customers are getting a bit wiser to it. One of the things with Triodos is they're very sort of transparent about who they invest in. You know, they publish it on their website. Anyone can see it, which obviously they can do because they're very ethical. I think doing that would be much more difficult for some of the bigger banks. So it, you know, that something is probably going to have to happen sort of policy-wise to force bigger banks to become, you know, as ethical on a level as banks like Triodos. But I think we possibly will see things sort of starting to lean a bit more in that direction over the next few years.
All right, then. Well, sticking with the climate, well, let's talk about petrol, but greener petrol, specifically something called E10. You may have seen it at the pumps. You may have heard about it. You may have read about it. But what is it, and can it go in my car? Simon?
E10. Mm. E10 is a little bit controversial. Okay, now this is to do with making petrol greener. So what on earth does E10? Well, E10 petrol is designed to cut CO2 outputs from road transport. But the way that it does this is it involves more ethanol being put into it. So it's a reference to the ethanol or bioethanol mix in the fuel. In the case of E10, it's 10%. In the case of what we were previously buying on the forecourt with standard petrol, it's E5. So that's 5%. And the higher the ethanol mix, the greener the fuel. And that's because the bioethanol content is an alcohol-based product created from the fermentation of a range of plants, including sugarcane, cassava and hemp, as well as grains, potato and waste wood, i.e. not a fossil fuel. There is a slight problem, though, okay, which is that the vast majority of modern-day petrol-powered cars will be absolutely fine to run on E10. However, it is estimated that between 600,000 and 700,000 older vehicles are not compatible with E10. The vast majority of these are going to be classic cars, but they might be more modern classics, ones that, you know, aren't that old, you know, 25 years old kind of thing. And even some vehicles made in the last 20 years could be at risk. There is a compatibility thing that you can check on the government's website. It has been criticized by some in the car industry and in the classic car world for not being the most accurate thing, and then suggesting you go check with the manufacturer. Checking with the manufacturer on whether your 30 or 40 year old car can run on a certain petrol is possibly not going to be that easy to do. Also, a lot of people just don't really know anything about this. So that it's caught them by surprise and probably haven't even registered, and will just pick up the pump and fill up their car and they won't even know. So you'd think that most people who are classic car fans might know that, but some people might just run older cars. And what it does is it can cause increased problems within the engine and the mechanicals. It's not a kind of, it's just going to suddenly conk out. It's not like filling up your petrol car with diesel or your diesel car with petrol. It's not that bad. But if you regularly use this stuff, it's probably not going to be so good. What you will find anyway is that quite a few people running older or classic cars might be using super unleaded anyway. And it's not a problem with super unleaded because super unleaded isn't E10. So for example, but it is more expensive, unfortunately. So my car, my old car, my Peugeot 205 TTI, I have to run that on super unleaded, because it's a higher octane fuel and it's just better set up for how the car is set up. It was set up when you had higher octane fuel. So be careful, basically.
Vast majority of us though.
Vast majority, absolutely fine. Right. We got some data here from the RAC. And the most registered cars that are incompatible with E10 fuel, number one, the most of them registered still on the road, Volkswagen Golfs. There's a lot of Volkswagen Golfs around.
Yeah.
Obviously not I think it depends on the age of them, obviously, but you know, some people will be running an older Golf just as a normal everyday car. MGBs, again, classic car, you think people would be quite engaged. Mazda yeah. MX-5s, a lot of MX-5s still on the road. Nissan Micras, a lot of Nissan Micras. What's that? Watch out, pizza delivery guys, next time you fill up your car. Morris Minors, Rover 25s, MGFs, the more recent MGF, Ford Escorts, the Rover Mini, and the MGTF as well. So just be aware of it. If you're running a car, check that your car can run on it. And if it can, then you can relax, not worry about it.
That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the podcast past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.